Hello and welcome to The Garden Show. I'm Molly Kapler. And my co-host Kitty is here.
Yes, I am here.
We're just getting our technology organized. It's kind of like the beginning of the garden season. You got to get all your tools ready to go and your supplies.
Indeed.
Here we are.
We clean them up. We sharpen them. We locate them in our garden. And then we start using them, hopefully.
Well, thanks so much for joining us this morning. I'm delighted to be here with Kitty. And thanks to Becky for having us in on the Good Day Garden Show. What a year.
It is. It has been kind of a wild, well, we won't talk about the other stuff, but it's been kind of a wild winter spring so far for gardens. You know, we were like thinking, oh, yeah, you know, things are going to start up early. And then we got some serious cold. And then we got hit with that beautiful warm weather. And then it went back to normal. So it's good to be nimble. I would say nimble.
I would agree. And I think another just time point to keep in mind is that May 15th is our official frost-free date. And we're still a week out from that. So you can kind of look at the forecast for about a week out. They're really quite accurate. So it doesn't look like we have freezing weather in the next week. But we have had definitely frosts past the frost-free date in years past.
Indeed.
So nothing is guaranteed. Mother Nature is in charge.
Indeed. So it's nice to be ready. You know, if you get things all planted and all that, it's nice to be ready to protect things or move them inside, you know, however you have to protect them. But what kind of what Molly and I were both thinking about when we first started talking about this morning's show was that gardening is not about guilt. And I know that it was like, well, no kidding, Kitty. but it's, you know, there's always that should have, you know, oh, gosh, I wish I had gotten this done. And my neighbor already has this stuff growing and I've got nothing going on. And it was like, you know, you don't need to approach gardening with, you know, mea culpa sort of attitude.
We totally think you should enjoy yourself and focus on the process. Now, a lot of us are interested in product. We would love to eat delicious things coming out of our efforts and enjoy the flowers that we plant and grow. But just remember that there's something very soul-feeding about the act of cultivating dirt and growing things. And that's the place to focus rather than comparison to someone who seems to either have it all together or they have the perfect space or whatever you're feeling self-critical about. So we want you to go out there and really enjoy yourself and not take it on with a whole lot of shoulds.
Yes, indeed. So one of the things, now I'm going to say, one of the things you should do, though, is to kind of think about your spot. You know, sometimes when you're doing that comparison, it's like, you know, they're ahead of me, their garden is going. A lot of it's microclimate. So you really do need to kind of have some awareness of, you know, where things are. I've noticed in certain parts of town, you know, gardens are really, they're further ahead than mine. You've got the asphalt being, you know, kind of a heat sink that really adds some warmth. You know, out on the island, I don't have that. I have kind of more fresh ocean breezes and things like that. It's things are going, but they're a little bit behind. And I imagine there's areas in town, maybe like Indian River Subdivision.
Right. So I live in the Indian River low area is what we call it. And we have quite a bit of cold air that it seems like comes down the Indian River valley and right into this part, you know, my part of town. And we're often much chillier than other places. And so that has a great effect on what's happening. I think we're at the time period where if you do a lot of season extender work, either you have a greenhouse, you use a lot of Remay, you have put cooking type things, you know, heating up type things in your beds, a lot of herring row or hot manure or hot compost, you've got black plastic, you know, these are all strategies to warm your soil. So, you know, you can't control your location at this moment. You could move next year, but at this moment you can't. So what you can do is assess your situation. And is your soil really warm? And if your soil's super cold, be judicious about what you plant. So there's some things it's time to plant and you can go for it. And there's a number of things that it's probably not time to plant if your soils are still really cold.
So I did want to make one comment about plastic. And it's not, you know, should you use plastic or not? That's your decision. You get to decide, you know, how you're going to use that. But I did an experiment a couple years back that I was going to remind folks about. And I put temperature sensors about an inch and a half in the soil underneath black plastic, clear plastic, and remade. And of course, I had a control, right? With no cover. And the one that heated up the most was the clear plastic. So think about that. If you're going to, you know, black plastic has its uses. It shades things out, right? So if you're trying to kill weeds, maybe that's a strategy. But if you're just trying to warm up, the clear plastic, I've also used clear, like, scrap roofing pieces, you know, like the corrugated clear roofing pieces. I've thrown that over beds, too. It does make a difference.
So there's lots to do, even if you don't have your seeds yet, or you haven't purchased your bedding plants or your starts. And there's no one right way. And both of us have done the, should we start our seeds inside and transplant, or should we buy starts, or should we direct seed? And you know what? Every year it's different, and that's the wild part of it. So we like sometimes to talk about this strategy of hedging your bets and doing both direct seeding and starting inside. If you started your seeds during that really sunny weather a month ago, some of them might be kind of long and straggly now, and they are going to struggle in the transplant. I'm not saying don't transplant them, but carefully harden them off and know that they might struggle. And you might second guess yourself by doing a little bit of direct seeding because we're really early. Remember, it's not even frost free.
Right, right. So I invested in several lights actually for in the house, and they're kind of cool now. They're LED ones that are red and blue, and they look pretty, I don't know, very space age. But that has been the ticket for me for growing seedlings indoors, is having that additional light. So they look pretty good. I have, you know, tomatoes, I have leeks. So I did get some stuff done. I have calendulas that look like bedding plants essentially, but it's because of those lights. And so that makes a big difference. At this point in time, if I'm starting things from seed, I'm starting them outside. Even if it's covered, and I will be covering them if I start them outside. And I do that anyway. I do that for a couple reasons. One, it gives them a little warmth. It gives those seeds very even moisture. It helps do that. It keeps the robins from digging them up and all those sorts of good things. At this point, I'm probably not going to start any indoors unless it's basil.
Right, which is indoor or a very covered crop in our part of the world.
Yeah, for me, that's definitely been one of those things. So I did start a bunch of things, but there's a lot of things I just didn't get to. And again, I was like, should I feel bad about this? And I was like, well, it won't help feeling bad about it. So I have some little tiny seedlings that maybe will go out, but I'm going to start direct seeding. I did direct seed a couple of things. I've done the peas. And fava beans. I decided to give those a little bit earlier start than I did last year. We'll see how that goes. I thought the fava beans did super well last year, so I'm pretty keen about having them. One thing I did learn was that if you grow fava beans, you need to build in support. Like now.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you have a scrambler, either a pea variety that's a scrambler or bean variety, the fava beans, regular green beans, if you're new, know that you need to grow them in a covered manner here, or up against a really warm wall or something like that. Our regular temperature gardens, not usually a real effective for your standard sort of green beans.
No, sometimes people do well. You never know. If you're a person that has space and energy and interest, do it as an experiment. I mean, I'm not saying don't experiment, but know that it is an experiment.
Right, right. And your likelihood of great productivity might be low. It's a great time to plant potatoes. And if you haven't had a chance to get them out of where you store your seed potatoes, or if you're just purchasing them at the nursery or they're coming in the mail, it's great to set them in a window and do what's called greening up. That sort of gets them thinking about, oh, it's time to grow. So I prepared my bed. I had some compost to put in, some herring roe, and I wanted to do that and let it cook for a little bit before I actually planted my potatoes. So my bed's ready now, and I've had my seed potatoes in the window for a couple of weeks, and I'm just waiting for the combination of a weekend and decent enough weather for me to do it, or an evening or whatever. So yeah, potatoes, great time. Kitty, you said you've already planted your peas. Both edible and sweet peas can go in. This is a good time to start spinach and some of the hardier greens. Those can all go in. Your kales,
arugula.
Yeah, all those you can direct seed right now. Carrots, maybe. If you have a very warm spot and you can warm up your bed, fine. But for the most part, I won't be planting my carrots yet. I'll be waiting to be one of the last things I plant, because we struggle with germination here. Now, I heard from somebody who said their carrots are already up. And that's because they either have a very warm location or they did some mitigation early on to make sure that their soil was warm enough for germination.
Carrots are fussy. It's kind of odd. Once they get going, they actually do, I think they do pretty well for me. I have a sunny spot. I really cultivate the ground deep into the soil. I like literally stick my fingers in, and I'm like looking for rocks and, you know, sorts of things that will impede my carrots. That's probably way overkill. You probably don't need to do that, but it gives me a certain amount of satisfaction. But I do notice that germination is variable. I do much better if I religiously keep it covered with row cover, and then, you know, slowly lift that up and peek. But the bed needs to kind of maintain this even moisture. It seems to do better with that. And my raised beds do drain actually pretty quick. And if we get those hot spells, I really need to keep it covered and actually even sprinkle it a little bit, which is wild.
The other thing is carrot seedlings, if you've grown them before, are very tiny and fine, and they get mowed down really easily by pests. So if you have a fair slug population around your garden beds, the first thing that's going to be gone are your carrot seedlings, and you'll think you didn't have adequate germination if you missed them, but actually they germinated and the slugs took them out. So that's another place to like check every day, for example, if you're just right at the edge of when they're supposed to germinate. So yeah, I haven't done that yet either. Kitty, there's so many things to do right now that even if it's too chilly for some, you know, of the jobs for tender plants, or your plants aren't hardened off yet or whatever, but you can still do any trimming of anything on your shrubs that looks like winter kill. Great time to get that taken care of. In fact, the sooner the better for that, actually. And then the other piece is we're heading into roadie season, and if you haven't fertilized your roadies, this is a perfect time. Granular rhododendron and azalea food is always, commercial azalea food is always what Kitty and I recommend, and it's what I use. It's the only specific fertilizer I use. Like, you can go to the store and see fertilizer for every type of plant. Mm-hmm. Roses, tomatoes, you know, this, and this. Those things are all fine. They're specifically formulated for those things. But if you're growing everything, you're generally going to look for a more generalized fertilizer and work from there. But rhododendron and azalea food, that's the one we swear by.
I do indeed, and I don't like the liquid stuff. There's stuff that you mix up in liquid, and I was like, too much work for me. But I do fertilize each one of my rhododendrons, and they take a lot. But I do follow the instructions to a T, which may also be the only time I follow the instructions to a T, because giving your rhododendrons too much food is like giving them a, maybe not a death sentence, but they will not be very happy with you. Too much is not a good thing.
Right. You might wonder, what does that look like when you over-fertilize your rhododendrons? And before I even say what it looks like, I would second your don't use the liquid. The liquid washes out at the next rain, and the granular at least is going to be there as long as it takes to dissolve into the soil, and that's what you want, a little bit slower release so that the roots of the rhododendron are going to take it up. But what a rhododendron looks like with too much food is the leaves all look burnt. They start getting spots and black edges, and they just look very unhappy. Now, they'll recover. They'll drop those leaves eventually if it's not really bad. So don't don't freak out if you have done this.
Do not dig up your rhododendron and throw it away.
No, it's going to be okay. But it's definitely telling you, oof, that was too much.
Yeah, so one of my rhododendrons is already blooming. It's actually covered with flowers. And it's not one of my ones that's typically the earliest. It's my crazy weird yellow one. Not my beautiful little curlew, but this kind of blue-green foliage yellow one that the flowers are like nothing to write home about, but it's like covered with them. So I need to get on that. I was thinking of all the things that I'm just about, the semester's over, right? I'm at UAS. So now after today is like, to me, it's like open garden season. I'm like, all right, I can start getting to all these things that I was like, oh yeah, I kind of wish I had had time to do that. And honestly, the first thing on my list is fertilizing my rhododendrons because they pay out dividends forever. And they're just getting like huge. So I was going to say it's the time to buy rhododendrons. If you want to buy them, read the freaking label. If it says it is 6x6, it's probably 8x8.
Well, that's the thing. We have a very robust climate for rhododendrons. It's perfect. And so a rhododendron that might be a little bit smaller in another climate is really going to be a little bit, or maybe a lot of bit bigger here. So we really do advise that you read the tags and get enough space for them. The other thing is consider how shady it is. Sometimes rhododendrons, people think rhododendrons do best in shade. Well, in hot, sunny, dry places, they do best in shade, but they don't do best in shade here. Our rhododendrons can take full sun, and you're going to get best performance if you plant them in as much sun as possible.
Yeah, I was going to say that the biggest one I have is one that's called Blue Peter, and it is probably 12x12. It is nuts how big that rhododendron is. I thought, oh, it'll be, you know, nice 6x6, something like that, and it's just, it's impressive. It has filled almost the entire one side of my yard, which is fine because I have like 3 acres. But if you don't have that much space, you don't want a rhododendron quite that big. And I could prune it back, but right now it's kind of fun to think of, like, I feel like this is like what rhododendrons in the wild look like. You know, it's this giant shrub. You can park a bench. You could probably park a tent under this thing. It's pretty impressive. So beware, you know, think carefully before you buy.
And if you're looking to buy, there's a couple of varieties that do really well here. The Ramapo or Ramapo, I don't know the preferred pronunciation, but it is a small-leaved rhododendron with lavender flowers. It often double blooms, meaning it blooms again at the end of the season. And it is one of our most hardy rhododendrons. Mine is years and years old, decades old, and it isn't a tall one. So the tag is going to tell you that it's a small rhododendron, but you know what? Mine is about 10 feet across now.
Right.
So it's growing out. It's not a tall plant, but it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's kind of crushing my garden bed, but it's pretty hard to complain because it's such an amazing plant. And then right next to it is, if you're interested in an azalea, and you can get any of the Northern Lights series. They are really tough. They're related, of course. Deciduous, they drop their leaves, but when they bloom, it's wild times. Mm-hmm. It's garish pink in my yard when my Northern Lights blooms. So those are two that are really tough. So check it out, what the range of hardiness is on the tag. And if you're just starting out, go for something that's well in our range. We're range 7, our areas, what's a USDA?
Zone 7.
Thank you. I need that word, zone. We're zone 7. And then think about your location. Is it really windy? Wind is not great for rhododendrons. But other than that, you're in pretty good shape.
It depends. So I have tested the wind hypothesis pretty extremely where I live, living on the end of an island. And the one that gets the full blast is Vulcan, and that's a red one. It is gorgeous. It doesn't care. There's probably others that are like, no, I'm not going to put up with this nonsense. But Vulcan, and I think there's Vulcan's Fire now. I'm pretty sure Vulcan is not available in commerce anymore, but the derivatives from it tend to be pretty tough. And I was going to like underscore those Northern Lights azaleas. They are so much fun. I have an orange one, a yellow one, and a hot pink one in a row. And it's like, wee-ha, if you need some color. And honestly, I think it's nice to have some color here. We have great, beautiful, natural colors in the forest and in our landscapes. But, you know, sometimes you just need that big splash, the fireworks in your garden. And I think the Northern Lights can really supply that fireworks.
Nice. So what else is going on in your garden? You talked about that you managed to survive with your rosemary. Your yes. Rosemary managed to survive under your care.
And me too. I did learn a few years ago that you have to bring rosemary in someplace at some point, and generally before December. And I did that and kept them, and they look great. So the rosemaries look really good. Somehow my lavender has survived all this outdoors. And, you know, I had one forever that did that too. So, you know, I must just have the right spot for it. The garlic is probably about 8 to 10 inches tall. So it's doing really well. I gave it a little boost with some herring roe. Give it a little shot there. Scallions actually also look good. So things are going there. One thing I wanted to suggest that people think about starting, if you've kept over dahlias or begonias or gladiolas, it's a good time to get them going someplace protected.
So I started my glads inside in pots a while ago, and they're about 16 to 18 inches tall now. I have them in the greenhouse, and I've been monitoring because they don't tolerate frosty weather much. Mm-mm. So I knew so they're doing great, and mine will be actually ready to transplant right after frost-free. Yeah. So I'm kind of ahead of the game on that. I wintered over 3 dahlias, and they were already starting to try and grow. So it's been a few weeks now, but I took out around the dahlias all of the soil, added back fertilizer, used some Osmocote, which is a slow release, and a little bone meal, and filled in with some fresh potting soil. And they're starting to get going. So it's pretty easy to overwinter dahlias here. You do need to feed them up. I mean, you think about how much a dahlia puts out. The plants are big. The flowers tend to be pretty robust. So do feed them up. Renew soil. Add back amendments so that they really have something to go on this season.
So last year I had a really fun experiment. We grew dahlias. Several of us grew dahlias from seed. And they not only grew well, they flowered, and they flowered beautifully. And those are the dahlias that I have now that I've saved over. So you can start from, you know, the tubers that you buy, or you can start from seed. And both seem to work really well. I was really impressed. I had mine were outside the whole summer. I did not give them too much fuss except for trying to protect them from deer monsters. But other than that, I was like, here's some food, keep growing, here's a little support. But man, they were just gorgeous. That pack of seeds paid back in spades.
Nice. My fuchsias made it through the winter. So I composted one. It was at the zombie state, so that's a goner, but I have 4. They're hanging inside in the windows. They can take a tiny bit of cold, but coming straight out from storage, there's no reason to. So keep your fuchsias going in a warm spot. They need a lot of feeding up if you aren't changing out the soil in the pots. You know, you're not potting them on. And I tend not to do that much. Instead, I just feed quite a bit and a little refresher of soil on top. But this year, mine are really robust. I'm super excited for frost-free to come and be able to hang them outside.
Nice. Oh, one of the things I wanted to suggest that people think about doing is taking photos of their garden periodically. And I just did that because I've noticed, believe it or not, there are areas in my flower garden where there's no daffodils.
What?
What is happening over in that corner? I mean, it was just like an outrage to me because I love daffodils. I don't know. Molly knows. Probably everyone in the listening audience knows that I'm like a total daffodil freak. They come in so many colors. Deer do not eat them. in my experience.
Right.
So
if you're
me,
struggling right now with the fact that all your tulips have been eaten off, which is a normal thing, or perhaps your crocuses went.
Yes. Trout lilies, they like those
maybe
too.
Your trout lilies are gone. Yeah. If you're having those problems, go the kitty route and go with daffodils because, you know, you can find an abandoned homestead in Alaska where no one is doing anything. And you know what is blooming there?
Daffodils.
Daffodils. The other thing that's blooming there are the daylilies. Daylilies mm-hmm. are not eaten by the deer either, and they're really tough. So if you know, take notes from the Tongass.
Oh, yeah.
Daffodils and daylilies, the double D, they'll get you forward on having tough plants that the deer are not going to eat.
So, yeah, so I took a picture of this corner because I was just like, what happened over here? Because it was in an area that I'd kind of been, you know, trying to clean stuff up. I was home a lot last summer for some reason. And so I was, you know, cleaning things up and I was like, oh, I did not put some things back over here. So it was very sad. So that's been, you know, photographed and noted. And I will be fixing that little problem really soon. I was going to say the other bulb that's super tough that I've found in like abandoned like mining cabins is those Spanish bluebells, they're called.
Mm-hmm.
Those are still growing after all those years. So I have a bunch of those in my garden too. Speaking of deer, though, I have an announcement to make. Becky's like, what are you doing? I bought a big giant pile of 8-foot metal fence posts, and I have it kind of looks like Fortress La Bounty, but I build a much more intense deer fence this year, and it's further back from my garden. So before, I think it was like close enough that temptation was like, I was like, I just have to do a little bit to get in there. This one, there's like a buffer space between the fence and the garden, and I'm hoping that works. I mean, it's a little, there's some moments. The gate right now is a beaded, you know, those old beaded curtains that you'd put in doorways because I didn't have a gate yet. But I was like, maybe deer don't like to walk through beaded curtains. I don't know.
Sounds really festive.
It is. It's lovely. It will go really well with the azaleas.
Yeah.
So, yes, I'm super excited about this. And I'm hoping it works. I will give reports.
Yep. There's a lot of strategies to work around deer. One of them is, of course, just raised beds that you cover carefully and clip down your Rimae or your spun row cover. And while we haven't extolled the virtues on this conversation this morning of spun row cover, we both believe in it thoroughly. It helps warm the soil at this time of year. It protects your small plants from both birds and deer and marauding cats or dogs of your neighborhood. And it also, as we move into just a little bit warmer time, it's going to save your brassicas from the root maggot pests. So there's every reason to use Rimae.
Yes, it's the stuff I count on every year. One last little comment. We were talking about peas and favas. And I did want to say that people often think that they need to buy inoculum so that you get your little nitrogen-fixing bacteria with your peas. It's around. You do not usually need to supply that inoculum unless, I don't know, you've done something really outrageous to your soil that's killed off all the microbial life. But those, they are around. I actually pulled up all my fava beans last year and took pictures of their roots because that's who I am. And they all had really nice nodules. So that's one thing that I think you can save your money on.
I think another strategy is to compost and use compost in your garden. I'm not saying you're necessarily going to have the pea inoculum in your compost, but what you are going to have is a robust mixture of nutrients and micro, you know, organisms that really help build soil. And that soil building is what promotes robust plant life.
Indeed. And not treating your soil, you know, with harsh chemicals. I mean, in the end, that's really one of the things that starts knocking down, or actually even over-fertilizing can knock back the microbial life in your soil. I'm not saying you shouldn't fertilize, because I do, but there is a balance in there.
Yeah, so thinking about soil health is always good. A lot of people talk about what do we, you know, how do we do that? And if you're new to gardening, garden up one of your beds and keep one of your beds and just be building it, maybe. You know, just really working on that soil and rotate, trying to get that soil with as much as possible. This was a great year for herring row.
Oh my gosh, it's been
a couple years where it's been difficult to get on the road system. So there's still some around. If there's seaweed that's broken off and has herring row on it. I saw some this weekend out at Cruise Off.
Mm-hmm.
If you happen to have a boat, can get out there. If not, that's just a perfect fertilizer for us. Probably have to cover it to keep the dogs and bears out, but
yeah,
really good stuff.
Yeah, I definitely dig all mine in when it comes. It has a rather strong scent, so it's definitely worthwhile. Well, we hope that we are here next week talking to you some more about what's going on in our gardens, and yeah. Thanks
for
joining
us. Let us
know
your questions. We'd love to do a call-in version, so let us know what you want us to talk about. It's gardening season. Thanks so much for joining us.